Hello and welcome to episode 93 of the Blue Cup Tools podcast. I am Francisco Gonzalez, also known as Grunislav, and with me as always...
Hello, I am Ben Chandler, also known as Ben304. How are you, Francisco?
I'm well. I'm eating an omelet right now, so you'll have to excuse my chewing noises. Aside from that, I'm doing pretty well. How are you?
I'm upset.
Why?
Because Jay's Games is shutting down.
Oh yeah, I heard about that.
That's crazy. That's actually, like, before Steam sales were a really big thing, like, I used to go on there a lot, you know, and I guess maybe that's one of the reasons that they're shutting down is because, like, with GOG and Steam sales, people play less online games because there's just so many, like, offline games to play now. But yeah, and they're always very supportive of AGS stuff, I thought. Well, you know, of not of all AGS stuff. They're always very supportive of me, basically. That's just selfish.
Okay.
But yeah, no, I'm quite upset by that. So yeah. I'm going to miss those people.
Oh, well.
Yeah, oh, well. The times change. Like, I accept that.
They do.
But I wish everybody there the best.
And, you know who...
You know, hopefully we'll see them around in some form or another.
Mm. You know who said that times change? It was Bob Dylan. And I don't know. I just thought I'd bring Bob Dylan up for no apparent reason whatsoever.
Well,
so there you go.
We've done it.
Yep. Good.
He's been mentioned for no apparent reason.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. How have you been aside from that?
I've been all right.
You've been up to?
Making games, playing games, living. You know. It's good. Life's good. Well, you know, I do my thing.
You went to the symphony last weekend, didn't you?
I did. I went and saw the Western Australian Symphony Orchestra again. It was very nice. Very good. Good. Took my grandma again.
Did you tell me that they had played Mozart?
No, I saw the Fremantle Chamber Orchestra play Mozart.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
I haven't seen the Western Australian Symphony Orchestra play Mozart. I know, it's hard.
It's hard to keep track of all this culture.
Oh, I'm so busy.
You're so cultured. You're like yogurt. Yogurt's nice.
I'm very, very dissimilar to yogurt. I want to clarify.
Yes, you are very dissimilar to yogurt. And you're not edible for one thing.
That's right, and you shouldn't store me in the refrigerator for another.
Well, I mean, sometimes you need it. But anyway.
I don't handle the cold well. That's not... I'm a heat kind of guy.
Yeah, I know. Anyway, you also went to the aquarium.
I did go to the aquarium. Last time I went to the aquarium was with Jacob Janeka.
Yes.
But my grandmother told me that she'd really like to go. And I was like, I'm totally ready to visit again, even though I visited it in November. So Western Australia's got a really good aquarium.
Good.
I remember going as a kid, and I was like, this is amazing. It's really good. They have a very long underwater tunnel where you can have, like, we had a massive stingray, like, over our heads, scraping stuff off the glass, and, like, a giant gray nurse shark just looking at us with its mouth open. My grandma didn't like that much. But, yeah, it's, you know, that was really nice. That was last weekend.
Well, perhaps next time I find myself in that part of the world, I will visit said aquarium. Although...
Yeah, we should totally go.
Yeah, although last time I was in Western Australia, we saw a lot of wildlife in the wild.
In the actual wild. We kind of had...
We saw rays, didn't we?
Yes, we did see rays in Denham. We went snorkeling.
Right, yes, and we saw stingrays.
But... they were quite big, but this was massive.
I just realized that today, 1 year ago today, I got back from my trip to Australia.
Well, there you go.
How about that? Anyway.
Our Australian trips were less in Perth and surrounds and more in the larger Western Australian area.
Yeah. Yeah. So, anyway.
Anyway.
Good. Speaking of tourism, I've been touristing a lot. My good friend from college came to visit me last weekend from Thursday to Tuesday.
You said you hadn't seen him for 6 years.
Yeah, I mean, well, I mean, I hadn't seen him in person for 6 years. I mean, we've been...
Well, I briefly shared a FaceTime chat with him when we were in Sydney.
Melbourne, actually. But yes.
Okay. I knew it was one of our tours.
Yeah, I've been FaceTiming with him regularly for like the past 4 years or so. But yeah, I hadn't actually seen him in the flesh, since 2010 when I went to go visit him in Houston. So yeah, it was nice to catch up and it was fun to go around New York and I think he had a lot of fun. It was his first time in New York City. And so I took him to all the cool spots. Of course, he was only here for a few days, so we didn't get to do everything. I mean, you can never really do everything, but.
Well, it's a big city.
It is a big city. So, but yeah, we did plenty of touristy things and it was fun. It was a lot of fun. So that's pretty much what I've been up to the past week or so, which means that I've kind of gotten a little behind where I wanted to be in my personal deadline for what I wanted to do.
Yeah, you were kind of lamenting to me the other day that you...
Yeah, I mean, whatever. I'm catching up, and I'm going to be working this weekend to catch up. So, yeah.
Fair enough. We do what we must.
Exactly.
To make it happen.
But that's all I've been up to on the personal front. So, okay. Yeah. Shall we move on to what we've been playing?
Okay.
I'll go first.
Do we have time?
Oh, we have plenty of time. I'll go first. I haven't played anything.
What kind of podcast is this turning into? We're talking about...
I don't know. It's terrible because I have
the
not...
orchestra and the aquarium and...
Well, we're learned men. We have...
We're not one, like, faceted gems.
Exactly. We have many... We're complex individuals with many layers.
Oh,
I'm not
complex. Yeah, I know. I can promise you that. I'm a very simple person.
Yeah, I know. Anyway, so yeah, I haven't like played. You like food?
that's the entire complexity summed up.
Well, hey, I like food too.
Well, there you go. That's how complex we're talking.
Yeah, here. You're right. Complex carbohydrates, perhaps.
Wow, that was well done. I like that.
Thank you. Anyway, yeah, I haven't played any games. Well, that's not true. That's not entirely true because we are recording our podcast at a different time this week, and
it's
now Friday evening. We usually record our podcast Friday morning, and I took a little bit of time this evening to play a little bit of the latest chapter of King's Quest, which is chapter 3, which came out to very little fanfare.
Very little.
A few
now,
days
you
ago.
Didn't like King's Quest too much.
I didn't
I
not.
Mean, chapter 2.
I didn't like...
But you like King's Quest 1 a lot.
Yeah. And I've only played about, you know, maybe about 30, 45 minutes of chapter 3. And I can say so far that I already like it a lot more than chapter 2. Okay. Even though I haven't seen a whole lot. Like, it's interesting what they're doing with the lore of King's Quest. And of course they had a little dumb cameo at the beginning from Cedric. But
oh gosh,
yeah. But it was done in an amusing way.
I refuse to allow the defense of Cedric cameos in this podcast. I'm sorry.
Well,
this is where I draw the line.
If it helps any, he didn't speak. He was a baby.
Okay, that does help a lot.
He was a baby. He was a baby Cedric.
Oh, good.
So there's this
so he's even more helpless than usual.
Yeah,
that's nice.
Well, so that's the thing. There's this cool little puzzle at the beginning, and I'm going to spoil it for people. But people have probably already played it. It's the very first puzzle. But the very first puzzle is sort of like a time travel puzzle, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting.
I like those.
Yeah, it's interesting because it starts off with like little skinny Graham. I mean, old Graham is narrating the story. So he's like, well, when I first came to Daventry, I wanted to be a knight. And like you walk past this pretty panorama of the castle in the background and like some mounds of dirt in the foreground that you can look at and you just kind of get close-ups of them. And you're like, oh, that's interesting. What does this serve? What purpose does this serve? So you walk over to the right of the screen and there's like this sort of, you know, pan of the forest and then it transitions to the exact same scene again. But now he's a little bit older and he's got the crown on and he's like, yes, when I was king, Daventry had become a wonderful place, blah, blah, blah. But now it's dark and it's rainy and you see that like there's a little tree growing out of one of the mounds and some thorns growing out of another one of the mounds. And then
Gosh.
You go over to the third, you go right a third time and now Graham is older and buffer, and he's like, but, you know, I was lonely, blah, blah, blah. And there's a little bit of, well, there's the trees have grown again. And then you walk over to the right, and on a rock is a nest of owls and a family of owls, you know, a mama owl and a papa owl and a older sibling owl. And then you have little Cedric owl in his vest and monocle. And if you get close, this badger comes and takes Cedric away, and the owls start crying. And he's like, no!
Why would you be upset?
Well, because he hasn't learned to speak yet, I guess.
That's true. That's true.
So he's like, no, that's not what happened. I must have forgotten a detail. And then there's a shovel. So you pick up the shovel. And then if you walk all the way back to the right to the beginning again, he's like, let me start again. I arrived in Daventry with my cape and things and whatever, and a shovel. And then you have to realize, then you do this puzzle where you walk between the three time periods and through clever use of planting acorns and thorns and things. The puzzle is you have to prevent little baby Cedric from being eaten by a badger, which...
That's nice.
It's pretty cute. It's a fun little puzzle. But anyway, I think it's interesting what they're doing with the lore, because basically it's retelling the story of King's Quest 2, where Graham kind of just goes on this quest and finds the girl in the tower. Oh, and the music in the background is totally Girl in the Tower, too, which is kind of...
Is it the same melody?
Yeah, it's the melody of Girl in the Tower.
That's funny, because like it's a very recognizable melody, so it is. Obviously everyone that's played King's Quest is going to know what's up.
It's total fan service, but it's done well. But anyway, it's funny because, yeah, like at the end of King's Quest 2, he goes up to the tower and you kiss Valenice and he asks her to marry him and she says yes and they get married and that's it. But here he shows up to the tower and like... You know
what, I gotta say, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm kind of sad that she doesn't say no and he's like, that's not how it happens, then you have to plant... acorns and things around her.
Well, but that's the thing. Like, you get to the tower here in this version, and he goes up to the top of the tower, and there's actually two maidens. One is named V, and the other one is named Nice. And he proposes to both of them, and they both say no, because they don't know him, and they've just met, and they don't even know if they like him. So, I'm guessing that... I mean, so far, I've just had to, like, pick things up and do, like, little social games with them and stuff.
Social.
Yes. But I'm guessing that the whole purpose of this, and judging from the Adventure Gamer's preview that I read, basically, you spend the game wooing them, and then at the end, one of them will be your canonical Valenice, which is pretty cool, I have to say.
Well, I really hope that you have to chase them through oak trees that you've planted.
maybe. And Hagatha shows up. Hagatha, who is the evil crone from King's Quest 2, she's like this weird lizard woman in this game, which is kind of cool.
I like the fact that they've managed to add the word hag into the name Agatha.
Well,
that's great.
Yeah, well, they had done that from, King's Quest 2, so you have to
I have not played King's Quest 2.
In King's Quest 2, she's a very standard, like, old hunchbacked green-skinned crone with white hair. Here, she's like...
King's Quest.
Yeah, here she looks like a lizard with a tail, with like this weird wig and tattered clothes and a cane. So it's a very interesting, and a giant turnip for a nose. And it's,
sounds like me.
Your nose isn't that big. I mean, you have to.
I know. I've got a cute button nose. What are you talking about? What am I talking about?
I don't know. Anyway.
It's true.
So King's Quest, that's really all I've played.
So that's what you've been playing this week, that's nice.
Yeah, and I've just been playing it literally like an hour before we started recording this podcast.
Wow. So. Well, I'm glad that you're enjoying it more than number two.
Yeah, well, yeah. So, I mean, I've noticed that in episodic games, the second game tends to always be the weakest one, so this is just, I guess, honoring episodic game tradition. So, we'll see what happens with the... with the rest of the series.
Give it time.
I guess I will. That's it. Of course, PAX East was last weekend, but I didn't go, and IndieCade East is this weekend, and I'm not going, so game stuff's happening, but I'm not participating. I don't know why I felt the need to say that.
it's our party, we can cry if we want to.
Exactly. Anyway, what have you been playing?
I finished Axiom Verge,
mm-hmm.
Which I liked a lot. I thought Axiom Verge was great. And I told you at about the 8 hour mark that I felt it would be about 10 hours long.
Yes, you did.
I was very incorrect. It took me about 14 hours to complete.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm used to being wrong, so that's not a big upset for me, but, yeah, so that was a good game. I liked Axiom Verge a lot. Good. And, you know, platformer style games really, it's super not my thing.
Yep.
A lot of the time.
Which is a shame. But, you know.
Well, it's not a shame because I've played a lot. Okay. I've really given them a good chance.
Okay.
And, you know, I know why I don't like them. Well, it's not that I don't like them. It's just that I like a lot of genres and I don't seem to like platform games as much as everyone else who likes platform games really likes them. So I like them, but not as much as, you know, most people that play platform games regularly. Anyway, so I finished that. That was really good. If you like Metroid-style exploration games. See, a lot of indie platformers that you get now seem to be like very quick, you know, oh, you died, start over, you died, start over, and kind of random generation that's sort of procedurally generated roguelike sort of
sure
deal.
And very twitchy. Which
isn't my thing.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a lot, because I prefer designed dungeons and things like that. So, Axiom Verge is the opposite. It's very slow, very methodical.
Sorry to interrupt you, but you talking about dungeons just reminded me. One of the places I went and I took my friend over the weekend was the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Yes.
Which you have expressed interest in visiting. And it occurred to me, they give you a map, and it occurred to me that the layout of the museum, each gallery is like a little square, and you have to, you yes. can, it's very easy to get lost and lose your way. So it would not surprise me. I had this mental image of you in the Met Museum, just like with your graph paper, mapping out the layout like a dungeon.
And it made me laugh. I was in IKEA with my grandmother the other week, and I was like, okay, this is totally the dungeon. They give you a map, and I'm like, all right, we got to do the, you know.
Yeah, that happens. Anyway, sorry.
That's how my brain works.
Please continue.
But yeah, so I liked it a lot, and I like how they approached a lot of things. It's one guy that made it all, which is incredible for a game that ended up taking me 14 and a half hours.
Mm.
But one thing I liked it about it, and this is really cool, is, you know, I got towards the end of the game and I could kind of tell, you know, there's enough story to let you know, okay, this is going to be the final bit and everything like that. And I was really struggling. I thought, I'm not doing well. So there's enough hidden extras that you can, like, backtrack and you can go around and, like, look for secrets that give you more health, that give your weapons more power. I even got a few bonus weapons and I went back and then I could get to the final boss much easier. Mm-hmm. You know, so I like that kind of, I'm not doing well, let me see what I can do and backtrack and retrace your steps and actually, you know, have a better chance at fighting. That's my kind of thing, more than, oh, start over and play for 30 seconds and then start over and play for 30 seconds. You know that. I prefer the slower, the long burn, I guess. I guess being a role-playing game fan makes me think that this is more like a role-playing game. Like Xeliad is the platformer game that I played probably the most as a kid, and that's very much a sort of long burn game.
Hmm.
You know, I never finished Xeliad because it gets incredibly tough, but
I never
that's kind it. Of like, yeah, you go into the caves and then you fight a few things and then you run back to town and the money that you made in the caves, you hopefully buy some stuff and then you keep doing that until you can progress to the next caves.
Okay.
So yeah, I prefer that. You end up learning the layout of a dungeon off by heart. I like learning things, you know, rather than
sure.
like, than just getting more skilled at the game, I guess.
You never really had a NES, did you?
I never had any consoles until I bought a Wii in 2007.
Of course. There was a game on NES that I really liked that I think gets a lot of flack, but I really enjoyed it, and I don't know why I'm bringing it up, but I just randomly remember it from time to time, and it was a it was a licensed game based on the Robin Hood Prince of Thieves movie.
Okay.
And it was really cool because it varied. It had several different mechanics. Like, it varied, between being like a top-down sort of dungeon crawler, and it was also sort of a side-scrolling platformer on some levels, and there were bits where it was almost kind of
like Zelda 2.
Not really at all, actually. And there were some bits that were kind of like tower defense in a way. And just like big battles where you had to kind of strategically move your guys around and stuff. Not sort of RTS-y, sort of tower defense-y. But yeah, it was really cool and it had really good music. And I don't know why it doesn't get much love. Oh, the thing that's funny is that even though it's based on the movie, like the portraits of the characters look nothing like their movie counterparts, which I guess they couldn't get the likeness rights or whatever, but it doesn't really matter because it's just, it's Robin Hood, so.
Well, that's the same for the Dune game. There's like three portraits that look like the film and then the rest are just totally all over the place.
Yeah. But anyway, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, if you have an old Nintendo or you have an emulator, check it out.
There you go. If you haven't checked it out by now, then Jesus, what have you been doing?
Anyway, yeah, I know. The movie came out like 25 years ago. So.
And the game came out a long time ago as well, clearly.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah, so I've also been playing some more Menzo Berenzen. I think I'm close to finishing that because I'm at Menzo Berenzen and I've done a bunch of the stuff in Menzo Berenzen. So I'm expecting to finish that soon. Mm-hmm. I'm enjoying it. Okay. It's still not as good as Ravenloft Stone Prophet, but I'm still enjoying it.
Good.
I've started reading Demons Don't Dream, which is the companion book, or the book that Companions of Xanth is based on.
I am the Grundy Golem.
What's that, sorry?
I said I am the Grundy Golem.
You are Grundy Golem.
Or I am Grundy Golem, yes.
Yeah, and so that's me preparing. I've nearly finished. I think I've got about 60 pages to go.
Okay.
I'm preparing to play Companions of Xanth once I finish Menzo Berenzen, which I think might be this weekend. That's my plan.
Okay.
I've also been playing Might and Magic Clash of Heroes on the DS, which is the first DS game I've bought in years.
Yeah. I told you I played a demo. Yeah, I played a demo of that on PlayStation 3. And I mean, I'm sure the DS version is very different, much like Ni No Kuni was different on DS than it was on PS3, but from what I remember playing, it was kind of cool.
Yeah, it's interesting because at first I approached it like a tactical battles game, and then I realized after a while I'm like, I'm not winning battles. Like, I've gotten into a harder spot, I'm not winning battles, and I realized that if you approach it like a puzzle game, then you win a lot quicker. You have to really think of it in terms of abstract concepts. So. Yeah, that's one I'm really enjoying. It's interesting to play something that plays more like a board game than most video games are that you're used to playing. But it is a little similar to Heroes of Might and Magic, whilst not being similar at all to Heroes of Might and Magic. So,
is there opera?
There is no opera, I'm sorry to say.
Then fuck that game.
You never played Heroes of Might and Magic 2 with the opera on anyway.
I know, and I feel so cheated.
Well, you cheated yourself, Francisco.
Well, it's only because I played the demo. I never played the full game.
But that had, it surely had the options in there.
No, well, but it was on a cover disc, so they didn't include the opera.
Ah.
Because it was just a demo.
Okay. Anyway, and the last thing
I opera is Red Book Cross
Artist.
Okay.
And Picross is basically challenging, well, not always challenging, some quite easy, and one or two very challenging puzzles about doing pixel art.
Interesting.
Mm. It's basically like being at work, so I'm still doing my job still.
Oh, well. It's been a while since I had a good toilet game. Ever since I got rid of Disco Zoo, I haven't had one.
Yeah. This is kind of, I've just been doing crosswords on the toilet since I lost my telephone, which I bought a new telephone yesterday.
Oh, really? What happens if you find your old one?
Who cares? Then I'll be able to continue my game of Pocket Trends.
Didn't you just buy a new SIM card recently before you lost your phone?
Well, I didn't buy a new SIM card. I had to get my SIM card changed in size, so yeah. Because I'd had a... This is a very boring story, so I'm not going to tell it, but yes, I did.
Okay. So you have like a brand new phone with a brand new SIM card now anyway, so it's moot.
That's correct.
Yeah. Did you get a new number too?
No.
Oh. Well, that's handy.
I got the same number I've had for a long time.
Yeah, that's good. Anyway. Good. Is that all you've been playing?
I believe that's all I've been playing.
Yeah, it's been a pretty scarce week for games for both of us.
I went away to the thing.
Yeah, we've both been a little busy, so yeah, it's understandable. Yeah.
I had too much Mendelssohn and Nurse Sharks.
Although I kind of feel like there is something else that I've played that I forgot to mention, but I don't know if it's true.
Nothing you've mentioned to me.
Yeah, no, I don't think I've told. No. Oh, well.
Doesn't matter.
Oh, next well, I tried to play a little bit more of Dreamfall Chapters, Book 4, but it crashed and we couldn't play.
That's a shame.
So, yeah. So that's I'm actually thinking about getting it whenever they port it to PS4 and just playing it as one complete game, because it's so hard to keep track of everything that's going on. But I found that
between just The Longest Journey and Dreamfall.
Well, yeah, but
oh, there's all this stuff.
It's even more so when it's
forgotten things.
Yeah, it's even more so when it's the same game. So yeah,
really,
yeah. And the thing is too, like each chapter, each episode or book or whatever they call them, they're not really standalone. It's not like, you know, Telltale game episodes or whatever that have sort of,
they run it like a TV series,
right? They don't come to any sort of resolution. Yeah, it just kind of ends on a cliffhanger, sort of, but not really. Gosh. And nothing really gets resolved, so
how upsetting.
Yeah, the pacing's not great. I think it would have worked better as a full game, but whatever.
I think it's hard to sell. I think it's easier to make money of doing episodes.
I guess, but it just seems like so much more stress and so much more crunch and everything, you know?
But there's always going to be, in big game studios, there's going to be stress and crunch anyway.
True, but it just seems like you're doing it 5 times more, however many episodes that you normally would.
I guess, but it does mean that when you get to the beta phase that you're not trying to blast through a whole game's worth of bugs, remember?
Yeah, true.
Which is always shit.
Yeah, it is. But whatever. Anyway, let's move on to this week's topic, which is sort of piggybacking off of the topic we discussed or argued about last week.
Oink, oink. It wasn't even the topic we argued about last week, it's just something that came up as a result of the discussion.
That's right, that's true. And it was,
you were talking about, yeah, breaking the fourth wall.
Yeah, it was interesting to see how much feedback we got on the AGS forum.
I think that's the most feedback we've ever got.
I think so too. It was good. We should talk about more controversial things more often.
Well, I didn't even realize it was controversial.
Well, it wasn't, maybe not controversial, but it was
definitely... Maybe me saying that I think breaking the fourth wall is okay is controversial.
Maybe. It's certainly divisive, if nothing else.
That's true. It is divisive.
Anyway, you wanted to expand upon the topic, so why don't you tell us what you want to talk about?
One of the things that you mentioned is that it's very easy to rely on tropes, and, you know, and the idea of having core archetypes and motifs to work into a story, you know... A lot of times when you are learning and studying other people's work, you learn about things like Chekhov's gun. Mm-hmm. You learn about things like cliffhangers. You learn about these techniques and these ideas that people use a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not necessarily stuff like, you get to think of like stereotypical characters. It's not necessarily that sort of thing. They work as well, but stuff like the hero's journey, you know, telling a story in 3 acts, that sort of thing. The sort of structures that are commonly used that can be found all throughout literature and all throughout film and all throughout games, I guess. I mean, the 3-act structure is, in adventure games particularly, has been adopted and championed quite a bit, as you know.
Sure, I mean, I used it in Shardlight.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's a point where you go, oh, it's easy to rely on those tropes. But, you know, sometimes it's good to step out of the tropes. And I'm not of two minds, but I think that tropes and motifs and archetypes very much exist for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to liken it to painting. A lot of the times people ask me when they see my process and they see things like I use a grid of thirds
mm-hmm.
over my pictures to help me align the composition, and I, you know, flip things horizontally to check the balance and stuff like that. And they say to me, don't you find that not only does that take the creativity out of it, but don't you find that it makes all your images look the same? Now, there's two things I think to be said about that. The first is
one is fuck you.
None of I wouldn't say that to someone asking a question. That would be awful.
Okay.
Unless their question is, would you like a copy of Uncharted 3? That would be my response.
That's harsh.
And accurate.
How do you know that Uncharted 3 wouldn't really like it? Anyway, let's not open this can of worms. Let's continue with your...
We've had enough arguments on the podcast. I would say, first of all, saying that using a grid of thirds is constricting is like saying painting onto a canvas is constricting to me. It's not something that you're bound by. It is something on which you can work off. It is a stepping stone. It's a springboard.
It's another tool in the toolbox.
It is another tool in the toolbox. It is, because a lot of the times you have what's called fear of a blank canvas. When you're first starting out your drawing and you don't really have much of an idea of your composition, of your layout, and you think, well, where do I start? Obviously, you've got several key elements you want to work into the scene. So once you've got a basic structure down, or even before then, you're going to focus on putting those in. Where do I start?
Sure, it's the same thing with a blank page when you're writing something.
Yes. So what you do is you start with this tool, this guide. You have a grid of thirds. So you think, well, if I put one of my, you know, if I use this, I get a rough idea of what I'm going to do. It's like having a blank page and you think, well, where am I going to start? You think, well, if I've got a three-act structure, how would I split it into three acts?
Right.
You're not bound by this thing. You are actually empowered by it.
Mm-hmm.
And people have said to me, well, I find that it makes shots look quite sterile. And it makes things look less immersive. And I say to them, well, one thing you have to remember is the way that our adventure games particularly work is that shots generally will look sterile because I'm trying to paint real world.
Sure.
And I have to do it in ways that are walkable without much scaling. So things always look a bit... You always have the camera pulled back a little bit more than you'd like as an artist.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that that particular thing is a side effect. I'm definitely of the opinion that you can go overboard. There's a few classic paintings that I've looked at myself and gone, oh, you've stuck too close to the grid and it actually takes me out of the picture. You've made a very square, boxy picture that I don't like a lot.
It's sorry to jump in, but I have... mentioning it again, I was at the Met and I saw a lot of paintings and there was a lot of landscape paintings and I was thinking about the grid and the rule of thirds and all that. And there was a couple of paintings that were interesting because they mostly focused on the sky and the landscape was actually a very small part. So in a lot of their grids, there were just clouds, which was an interesting change from the normal, you know, guide,
that's quite true of a lot of landscape painters, though.
Okay.
Yeah, I said something myself a while ago to Ivan, like, man, all these paintings have got so much sky in them.
Hmm.
Who wants to show the ground, dude? Well, let's paint dirt for, you know, clouds are airy and evocative and light. And they allow you, having a lot of sky allows you to put trees up in them, allows you to put mountains up in them, allows you to put things.
Yeah, but this was like, I would say that the bottom thirds were half, like, it was half of the bottom thirds that were dedicated to the mountains and the trees and all that stuff. The bottom sixth. Yeah, the bottom sixth, yes.
Okay.
And the rest was just big open sky, which made the painting feel a lot more open, but it, yeah.
Well, there is a French artist that just paints clouds.
Okay.
And he spends weeks on them. And he gets them very good, but of course, they're clouds, aren't they?
Sure.
You know? But yeah, also, just because the third isn't completely obvious at first glance doesn't mean it's not there. Sometimes it can be very subtle.
Mm-hmm.
It can be a change of value within the cloud as well that denotes... And not all landscape painters use thirds. Right. It's very, very, very common. Mm-hmm. Extremely common. But yeah, so what I like to think of writing archetypes and writing motifs is that, you know, and I don't want to go too much into breaking the fourth wall because I feel like we've talked about that a lot.
Yeah.
You know, but I do think that that's just another technique.
Sure.
And I think just like thirds can be used really badly, any other technique can be used really badly and you just go, oh, you know, okay, that's too much.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of goes back to conversations that we've had in the past about art and art techniques, and this is turning into the art podcast this episode, but that's fine.
No, it's not.
Okay.
I just like disagreeing on the podcast.
yeah, that's fine.
No, it's not. It's going to be a long episode.
No, it's not.
Well done.
Yeah, anyway, yeah, so I've often lamented to you about, you know, learning techniques and trying to figure things out. And, you know, you've told me about the tool in the toolbox and all that stuff and different stuff like textures, for example. Like, you've talked to me about using textures and how it can be, like, in order to do it well, you have to do it subtly. And then there's easy ways to be able to use textures, and obviously it looks like you just pasted a texture onto your background or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true. Yeah, it's true. Like all of that, with all of these things, it's, they're things that are there. They're things that people use because we've seen textures in plenty of adventure game backgrounds, both
including our own.
Yeah. Yeah. Both, you know, yeah. Professional and independent or amateur, whatever you want to call them. And so, yeah, it's basically, it boils down to that, you know, it's just, if you have this thing that you're using, that's a well-established thing, it's important to have an understanding of it so that you can do it and get away with it, which you like to, it's a phrase you like to use a lot.
That's because that's just imposter syndrome talking.
What, get away with it?
Yeah, I think I'll get away with this.
Right, right. Well, yeah, anyway, it's important to understand it, like I said, and so that you know that you can use it in a way that doesn't make it seem like you're doing it badly, if that's not super vague.
Well, I would expand upon that and say the key to most things is consistency. If you've established a thing and you only use it, you know, sparingly.
Right.
Then use it sparingly throughout the whole game. If you've established a thing and you use it a lot through the whole game. It's when you start having, like, inconsistent stuff. Because when... It's interesting. With backgrounds, I often lament how terrible my backgrounds look. And then when I play them in game, I'm like, okay, that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
I can get over that. Once you put characters in a thing, once you're in game, the backgrounds really aren't that important. It doesn't matter if the composition sucks. It doesn't matter... The color balance, that stuff stops mattering a lot the second you put characters in.
Yeah.
Because the characters are the focal point and they totally, like, the amount of times that someone else has tweeted a screenshot of my game or posted a screenshot of my game in, like, a magazine or an online sort of, you know, game site.
Mm-hmm.
And they've put the character in a spot. I'm like, ah, oh, that ruins the composition terribly. But
yeah.
They don't, you know, they're not thinking about terms of composition. But yeah, it's, I will spend hours lamenting the composition of a scene only to have it not matter at all in the slightest.
Sure. You know, I mean, I was telling you, I was trying to sketch out a scene earlier today and I was just super frustrated because I couldn't get the composition right because I couldn't get the perspective to work. And in the end, I was just like, okay, I'm going to do this. And I got it looking, I mean, it doesn't look great, but I'm sure once I actually fill it in and draw it and add the other crap, you won't even notice.
And that's not always true. The other day, Andel tweeted a screenshot of his game where he's got like a building with a sort of path over water that's like a snaky path. And I looked at that. I'm like, okay, establishing shots, the composition totally matters.
Yeah,
because you're trying to evoke something. But once you're inside, oh, who cares?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, establishing shots are literally there to look nice. That's really, and to give an impression of a scene.
Yeah.
You know, whereas, yeah. whereas most scenes that I end up painting are indoors. The composition doesn't matter because you got to have the three walls.
Right. Yeah.
Well, fourth wall's usually broken.
See, anyway. mine was an outdoor one, so I had to be a little bit more mindful. But yes. Anyway, the whole point of this discussion is,
Well, I still have another point.
Go ahead.
Okay, so my first one was that there is a starting point, a stepping stone, everything like that. And my second point is, especially for someone that's learning, the abstraction and the simplification of something really helps you wrap your head around how it works.
Okay.
So once you break something down into components, it's much easier to grasp it. For example, perspective.
Yes.
Once you break perspective down into a series of interconnecting lines, it's much easier to do.
Mm-hmm.
Much, much easier. Once you break composition down into a series of techniques, it's much easier to do. Mm-hmm. So this sort of relates to the sort of, oh, I've got a blank page, I don't know where to start, but this is more, I don't understand composition. I need to break it down into several different things in order to make my compositions work.
Mm-hmm.
So when you've painted your, you know, when you've done your sketch or you've done your thumbnail, you then compare it to things that you know work, that abstract, that simplify the process into abstract elements. And then you get a better understanding of, is this working compared to, you know, is this working along these things that I know work? Is this working for the rule of thirds? Is this working to a perspective grid? Is this working to a thumbnail image? These things help you. So I think with story writing, with game design, everything like that, I know Dave does this a lot. He steps back and he says, okay, is this working for this? Why am I interested in this? You ask yourself these questions based along things that you know work for you. So they become yardsticks by which to measure your success or failure.
Mm-hmm.
And also when you've noticed failure, you go, well, why isn't this working? Oh, because it's not, you know, because I've got a perfectly symmetrical image in a spot where I don't want to have one. Right. Let me break it up into thirds. You know, why isn't this working as a game? Oh, because there's no, you know, there's no clear section where I define the motivation. Right. So I don't have that first. Yeah. So I think having that, you know, having, let's say an archetype like Chekhov's gun.
Mm-hmm.
If you get to the end of the game and you have this big twist and you go, well, why isn't this big twist working? Like, oh, because I didn't hint at it. I never set it up.
Right.
You know that Chekhov's gun is a tool which allows you to set something up. You go, okay, well, let me go put back and put something in that sets this up. Then it's going to be much more satisfying because it becomes a more intriguing reveal.
Right.
When you go, oh, I never noticed that. I never picked that.
At the same time, though. Yeah. At the same time, though, like you said, there are ways of doing it well and ways of doing it not well. Of course. Because there's.
Absolutely.
It's super easy to say, oh, well, okay, let me put something in here, and then you make it super obvious so the twist isn't really much of a twist because you see it coming from a mile away.
That doesn't devalue the idea itself.
It doesn't.
That devalues
that's the, that the implementation certain, of it, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So it's not, you know, going back to the fourth wall thing,
yeah.
You know, sometimes that can be a tool for comedy. And you think, okay, I want to break things. I want to break the flow up here a lot, you know. Mm-hmm. Playing Paradigm by Jacob, our mutual buddy, there's times where he breaks the fourth wall.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it works for him.
Mm-hmm.
And he thinks a lot, I find, about his comedy, a lot more than I think a lot of comedy writers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he's always asking me, hey, can I get some feedback on this? Do you think this works? Everything like that. Yeah, so for me, seeing someone approach it like that, yes, he's breaking the fourth wall. Yes, he's making dumb pop culture references and stuff like that, but he's doing it in a thoughtful manner and with sensitivity to his actual game itself.
Hmm.
And I think having that sensitivity to your game is very important. Mm-hmm. Because if you just jump in there and like, oh, I'm going to do this, then it's going to feel forced.
Yeah.
Well. It's the same with the Chekhov's gun. Look at Heavy Rush.
Well.
You know, but that's the thing. If you've got a big twist.
Yeah.
And you throw it in like Heavy Rain does it, I'm really not a fan of how that worked. And I think that's a really, what could have been a very powerful twist done in a very poor way.
Well, what's interesting about Heavy Rain is, I agree with you that the way that the twist is revealed is pretty underwhelming and pretty stupid. But if you go back and play the game knowing what the twist is, it actually puts all of the scenes... Heavy Rain's been out long enough that we can talk about it without worrying about spoilers, right?
I think it's interesting because let's spoil it. So Shelby's the killer,
right? Shelby's the killer, and the way it's revealed
is also the most relatable and human of any of the characters, which isn't saying much because the rest of them are just Barbie dolls.
Yeah. but like I said, like the thing is that when you are originally playing it before you know the twist, you just kind of think, okay, well. This guy, Shelby, he's a private investigator, whatever. He's investigating the killings. He has, I guess we'll find out what his reasons for it are. And he, like you said,
he's accepted that he was a PI. Like, right. I was like, he's a PI, he's on the case, that's what they do.
Exactly. And he, like you said, he's very relatable and he's very human and he's the most likable character. And then the rug gets pulled out from under us when we find out that he's the killer. And, yeah. But then, yeah, there's that initial anger and that feeling of betrayal of like, oh, well, I was playing as him. Why is it he's a bad guy? So, but then when you go back and you play the game again, it's actually quite clever what his motivation is because you realize that he's not really a private investigator. He's just trying to trick these people into getting the evidence that he needs to absolve himself from this crime.
And yeah, the real problem for me with Heavy Rain is not in any of that. The real problem is the fact that they misdirect you throughout about 80% of the story.
And the biggest misdirection is the scene.
There's no justification for that misdirection.
Yeah. The biggest misdirection.
It's completely discarded.
Yeah, the biggest misdirection, of course, being. Well, in Shelby's case, the biggest misdirection, I would say, is the scene in the typewriter guy's. Office where you like black out or you kind of while he's killing the guy like you it focuses on Lauren but the game misdirection of course with the Ethan blackouts and all that stuff that doesn't really go anywhere but
he wakes up in strange places his kid's missing
and
the timelines all tie in perfectly and none of that there's no even attempt to approach that after the twist is revealed.
Well, that got cut apparently, but it didn't seem like even with what got cut it would have made much of a difference anyway. So
but you can't cut a thing like that and expect people to accept it.
Yeah. Well, that's David Cage for you.
Yeah, anyway.
But yeah, I mean, I'm thinking of another game that has a twist like this, and also Statute of Limitation spoilers, but Resonance, where you find that one of the main characters that you're playing as, Ed,
is the bad guy,
yeah. And he then becomes the bad guy in the second half of the game when it becomes the buddy cop game, which is cool. But yeah, and then when you play it again, you realize that it's very well hinted at the beginning, but subtly planned, like the whole thing of the last number dialed being the number of the resonance device and his sort of like amping himself up to talk to Anna and stuff, which completely takes on a completely new context when you realize why he's doing it, which is cool.
You kind of project your own ideas onto that scene and then later once you've got his personality, you approach it totally different. It's nice to see a scene metamorph in that sort of way.
Yeah. And see, that's well done. And
of course, yeah, and that makes all the difference. It's very similar, but it's actually justified.
Yeah,
it's not,
and you
it's
don't not, right, and you don't really feel as betrayed because it's done in such a way where it makes sense. And
well, the point is that it's not. It doesn't discard the things that you were you know that you trusted. I trusted David Cage. And
that was your first mistake.
Yeah, that's the problem, is you trust that you're looking at not a reliable narration, but at a series of events, all of which matters.
Yeah.
And 50% of Heavy Rain does not matter.
Right. That's what irritated me, too.
And that's just put in there to throw you off the case completely.
Yeah. That's what irritated me, too, about Fahrenheit. And I know I've ranted about this before. But the key thing that irritates me about Fahrenheit is the fact that you're playing both as Lucas and as the cops trying to investigate him. So you're basically playing against yourself, which isn't really fun. I like, you know, when you play games like that, you have this sort of sense of excitement as Lucas hiding the weapon and trying to cover up the crime, and there's this thrill of getting away with it. And then immediately in the next scene, you're playing...
You know what to do.
Exactly. You know exactly what to do. There's no mystery there. You know, as the cops, where to investigate, what to look at. There's that completely dumb scene where you have to construct a police sketch, and, you know, I guess it's kind of cool in the concept that as you, you know, depending on how you want to play it, you can either be as precise as possible or you can completely get it wrong for whatever reason. But it seems so stupid to be playing it against yourself.
Yeah, I find it less conducive to immersion and more like being the puppet master or the dungeon master that's just like, well, I want him to win this time.
Exactly. Which has its place, but narratively it just, I don't know, it feels weird.
Well, it depends what you're approaching the game with, the like what intent you're approaching the game with. If you want to be the kind of person on the run, you know, you want to be this felon, that's a very satisfying experience. And if you go in thinking that that's the experience that you're going to get, yes, to some extent, but that's not the exact experience that the game's trying to convey. And I mean, you can criticize Fahrenheit or Indigo Prophecy, whatever you call it. You can criticize that for many, many things, but I do agree that it's a little odd. I mean, I really thought it was clever, but clever doesn't always mean satisfying.
The thing is, ultimately, it doesn't matter either, because the last third of the game, all that stuff gets thrown out the window anyway.
It's quite linear.
So,
Yeah.
So, whatever.
But, I mean, there's a lot you can say about the last third of the game. There's a lot you can say about the last
90%
of the game.
Yeah, there is. But we won't.
Yeah. But, yeah, it's interesting to see people approach these things. And I really like a lot of David Cage's ideas. And I wish he was doing them a lot better than he is.
Yeah.
I was talking to someone recently about Heavy Rain, and they kind of lamented the fact that it gets really close to doing what we want it to do and just failed, like stumbles right at the end.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, that means it should get 9 out of 10 because 90% of it's good, not 3 out of 10. But I'm like, that's not quite true, because that thing that it never ends up doing was a key foundational element that I trusted would be there that ended up not being there.
Yeah.
And when you've been, you know, it's
manipulated.
When you've been manipulated to that extent, when you've congratulated an artist on his new painting.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you've talked to him about all the things that you like, and then you find out at the end that it's a photograph printed onto canvas. You go, well, now that's not what I thought I was looking at.
That reminds me of Mr. Bean.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, so that's what it felt like to me, is like, you know, I've been looking at this thing going, oh, you know, this, and then like, you get to the end, you're like, oh, well, that changes what this is completely.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't do any of this. You took a really good photo.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not a very good analogy, but that's okay. I forgive myself because someone has to.
Sure. So going back to why we brought this up in the first place.
Jump back.
Yeah, jumping back. So, yeah, we got a little, I especially got a little rowdy last time in talking about how you should never break the fourth wall. And I probably got a little too ahead of myself, because like you say, it's not bad to break the fourth wall necessarily. It's just like anything else. It's very easy to do it badly. And if it's done badly, it just falls flat. And you really have to have an understanding of just the concept of wanting to break the fourth wall. Like, there's plenty of games I can think of where they break the fourth wall and it's done effectively. Like, the whole end of Leisure Suit Larry 3, that breaks the fourth wall completely. It's very... I was talking to you the other day. I asked you if you'd ever seen Blazing Saddles. Mm. And because that has a very break the fourth wall ending. In fact, the ending of Blazing Saddles, I think Leisure Suit Larry 3 is pretty much an homage to the end of Blazing Saddles, because it's very much very similar in a lot of ways. But it's funny and it works in both things, just because it's so absurd. Like, you know, it's anytime, you know, anytime in any movie where they make a joke and they like mug at the camera or something. It depends on how it works, you know. Like, there's some movies where it works. There's some movies where it's just groan-inducing, and it's like anything else. Like, yeah, in Austin
it's
Powers.
It's like anything. And here's the thing that gets me, and I think I posted about this on the forums, but people go, oh, it's hard to do comedy well. It's hard to do anything well.
Yeah.
Believe me, I spend my whole work life lamenting that I can't paint well. It's hard to write drama well. It's hard to do horror well.
Yeah,
there's a lot of cheap horror that I just go, oh, I just don't like this. And some people are more sensitive. Some people can totally tolerate cheap horror.
Well, that's the thing. That's very interesting you say cheap horror, because you can have cheap any genre. And you can
exactly.
And the thing is that you can name the things that make them cheap. Like, what's cheap horror? Jump scares, right?
Right.
Everyone hates jump scares because they're
right, but
they're,
a jump scare could be done well.
Right, exactly. And
that's what I'm trying to say.
Right, and I agree with you. And but the thing is that jump scares are sort of like the cheap, easy way to get the point across, instead of just, it's basically being lazy is what it boils down to.
I don't know about being lazy, but I think the next step, and this is something that I've said that Dave does a lot, is going, okay, well, why?
Yeah.
Why am I doing this?
It's very easy to...
What do I want to do
right
with this?
One of the most important things...
If your goal
things
is to scare the player, that's not a very lofty goal.
Right, exactly. If it's just scare the player for the sake of scaring the player, then that's stupid. Just, you put in a jump scare and you get it done. But if you want to scare the player with a good reason, that's completely different and more difficult. But going back, yeah, like, horror, cheap things are jump scares, sorry. Drama, the cheapest thing is just some forced dramatic moment, like killing a character or something like that or whatever. Comedy, cheap thing is, in the case we're talking about, just like breaking the fourth wall or saying, hey, this is an adventure game or whatever. Mm. So yeah, every genre
I also think it depends on context.
Yeah, of course.
Like, if you compare the ending of The Holy Mountain to, say, an adventure game character winking at the screen, you know, Herman Toothrot waggling his eyebrows.
That's one of my favorite jokes in Monkey Island, when he's like, and he's like, who are you talking to? Whoa, the people watching. And Guybrush just kind of looks at you and then looks back. Yeah. I always wave when he does that, but it's fun.
I like the fact that you've gone from a big rant to about breaking the fourth wall to really finding the endearing in one specific example. But yeah, that's the thing, is it all depends on context. It all depends on tone and sensitivity to your subject. Herman Toothrot is sold to you as this crazy old guy.
Right. So the fact that he's doing that,
do something crazy like that, is fun.
Yeah, and it totally works, because he is breaking the fourth wall, but at the same time, you can also dismiss it as the fact that he's just this crazy old guy.
He's totally breaking the fourth. He's not even breaking the fourth wall. He's climbing through the window and sitting in your couch with you. That's a really, really strong example. That's why I kind of got mystified when people were ranting about breaking the fourth wall, when Monkey Island is one of the most beloved series in adventure games, if not the most beloved series.
And it breaks the fourth wall plenty of times.
Yeah, well, it breaks the wall.
I mean, when you look at Monkey Island and he says, wow, this was worth the $59.95 plus tax.
Never pay more than $20 for a video game.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's constant in Monkey Island. One of my favorite jokes, as I posted on the forums, is the rubber tree gag.
Right.
Where it pretends to be a Sierra game. Like, all that stuff, that cracked me up so much as a kid, you know? And it still does. I still love that stuff.
Yeah.
And it's totally doing the things that everyone's like, oh, it's lazy and it's stupid. I'm like, this is one of the most beloved classics.
True. True. But if I can play devil's advocate here for a second, keep in mind that Monkey Island is considered by many to be a classic. And many games that have come after it have tried to emulate Monkey Island. And Monkey Island did it very well. And so you sort of have copies of copies of copies. Right. Monkey Island did it well, but it also, it's funny, it was like one of the first games to be so absurdist like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it was a pioneer in a lot of ways. And so, you know, if anybody can say, oh, well, Monkey Island did it. If I do it, it'll automatically be funny. But that's not necessarily the case, because if you don't put any thought or effort into it, it's just going to come off as forced.
Sure, we return to the why am I doing this?
Right.
Element. Yeah. Exactly. I think if you want to see a good homage to LucasArts games, you should play Time Gentlemen, Please.
Right.
Okay. Which takes what was good about Been There, Done That and really just takes it to the next level. There's a couple of twisty puzzles in there, but for the most part you go, okay, this is what a tribute to LucasArts should be,
right,
in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
More so than the Sam and Max stuff that Telltale did, and the, you know, I never got far in the Monkey Island stuff that they did, but that's more what I want, is people that know exactly what they're doing and have thought a lot about why it's funny.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah,
yeah, sure.
So I mean, we've talked a lot about this. We've taken up two podcasts with,
yeah,
but really.
But I wanted, I mean, to.
Our last podcast was mostly me talking about what I played. But it is true that it's possible to do this stuff badly. It's totally true. It's just possible to do anything badly. And if doing things badly was an issue, then I would have never started drawing, because I
well, drew, yeah, badly. Sure.
And you know, it's quite easy to. To sort of go, you know, it's a real shame, because a lot of adventure games are badly designed. You have really talented artists, really talented animators, really good musicians, and then a game that just really disappoints.
Oh, sure, but put it all on the designer, why don't you?
It's true.
I know.
Because I think a lot of the times it's very easy to see when art's bad. It's very easy to hear when music's bad.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's harder to tell, is this design bad or not?
Yeah. And of course, that's, yeah, I think that's more subjective than anything else. But I wanted to talk about a little bit about what you were saying about asking, why am I doing this? And I just wanted to chime in and say that, yeah, that's like, not only why am I doing this, but just, if you just try and poke holes in your logic, that helps a lot. Because if you step back, it's easy to just write something and be like, okay, this is going to happen. But then if you step back and think, okay, well, why is this happening? How is it possible for this to happen? Like, why is Chekhov's gun going to go off in Act 3? How is it going to go off in Act 3? Is this some sort of logical way for it to go off or whatever? That helps a lot, because it avoids plot holes and far-fetched situations and things like that. And yes,
I think having a very clear idea of who your characters are and what your world is before you write them really helps you work to that structure. There's a couple of times when you were telling me about things in Poe Dickens before you'd work the characters out. I'm like, that makes no sense. No one would do that.
I'm sorry, did you say Poe Dickens? What's that?
You don't have a title.
I know. To
it by the title that you've been calling it.
I know. For those don't of you who are
Scottish game bullshit.
Oh no, 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 no!
So tiresome.
No. I'm not going to do it. I just want to point out for our listeners who don't know what we're talking about that yes, Poe Dickens is the code name for the game I'm currently working on.
Pay attention, people. But yeah, so there was a couple of times when you told me things, and I'm like, well, why would that person do that? Who are they? You know, and you're like, oh, I haven't written them yet. I'm like, that really shows, because I can't see any way that a person would do that. That makes no sense.
Exactly. And then I went back and I wrote out all my characters before writing the stories, and then I wrote, and it made it like 10 times easier.
Yeah. Once you have that guideline established, it really helps you. Yep. And yeah, and ask, and like you say about logic holes, just kind of go, well, why would this person do that? And why does the player care? Why am I making people play this?
Right.
Why this bit?
Right.
Is this really important to the game, or is this just a cool bit that I want to shoehorn in?
Right. And it's, yeah, it's tough. It's very tough to ask yourself that question and have to let go of stuff. Yeah. Because, yeah, I mean, if you basically, you do have to ask yourself that stuff, because it's amazing how many things that you can realize that that end up just being your reason for having them is just because, well, because it's cool. Like,
oh yeah.
I mean, look at,
I think yeah. You especially fall into this trap.
Yeah.
You go, well, that's a cool bit. I want to put it in. Yeah. It's a cool bit, but is it necessary?
Right. Does it have purpose within the greater game world?
Yeah. Or is it just like, I want to draw a cool background.
Right. I mean, if you can fit it in and make it work, great. But you have to really work to do that, because otherwise, yeah, it's just, it's easy to design for concepts rather than design for actual game play and
story. For the actual experience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yep.
Like, not to spoil too much, but like, there was one of the cases that I was coming up with that I reworked completely. Basically, the whole reason I wanted to do it for what it was because I wanted to include a taxidermy museum, because I had this really cool mm-hmm. idea for a background that I wanted to do. And ultimately, it didn't really work. And
I would say, the structure of the case didn't work. And I hope you don't mind me saying this, but I would say, from all the crime novels I've read, from all the games I've played and everything like that, it's probably the worst criminal investigation. Like, this guy's the stupidest criminal I've ever encountered in any fiction.
Sure, and it's true. And, you know, you very astutely pointed that out, and I'm glad you did.
And when you kind of explained your motivation as being, I wanted to draw this scene, I was like, oh man, don't do this. Yeah. Don't do that. Have a proper gameplay reason. Be exactly. a storyteller before you want to be an artist.
Exactly, exactly. And in this particular case, I was able to repurpose it and include it in a way that made sense somewhere else, which is fine, because I still get to have my cake and eat it too, to use that old tired phrase, but that's just because I really like cake. But the point is that I didn't design it around the location. I managed to put my location into my design, which is what you ideally should be doing.
Yeah, art isn't a secondary factor in a game. It's a very big part of the experience, but it shouldn't be a driving force behind the narrative.
Right, exactly. Because it's very easy to paint yourself into a corner that way. No pun intended. Yeah.
Not really a pun.
Yeah, I guess.
It's just a metaphor that supports the actual literal definition as well.
Yeah. Well, actually, it's funny you say that, because part of the reason I was telling you earlier about, or I mentioned here, that I was trying to sketch a scene and it wasn't coming out the way I wanted, and
they never do.
I know, but
trust me.
But the whole reason, and I had to put a lot of thought into it, because I had to think about the architecture. What? Diddums?
Sorry. Yes.
Why'd you call me Diddums?
Don't you say I didn't? Maybe it's an Australian thing.
I would say it's an Australian thing. What does it mean?
If someone's upset and like, oh, I had to do this, like, you say I diddums to me, like, oh, I'm a bit, how sad. That must have been very hard for you. It's me showing mock pity.
I know. Anyway.
What are you doing now?
Well, I figured before you were showing mock pity, you were just saying some weird Australian thing that no one understands except you.
Crikey.
Crikey dingo. The baby ate more dingo.
That's a big baby.
Yes, it is. It always makes me laugh. Anyway, it's very easy to draw backgrounds. And
no, it's not.
Well, I didn't finish my sentence. Let me finish my sentence.
I just wanted to be a shit, all right?
Well, you get your wish very often, so.
That's true. I just go for it.
It's very easy to draw backgrounds and not put any thought into the architecture of your buildings sometimes. Like,
yeah, look at my career.
Look at what? Your career?
My whole career.
Wow, 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 wow. Right, but I mean, like, and this happened in Escape from Monkey Island a lot. Like, the interior views of the buildings didn't match up with the exterior views. Like, windows were in the wrong place.
I was always like, it's Pokemon. They do that all the time.
Yeah, sure.
You go into a tiny little mushroom, and it turns it to be like a 6-story apartment complex.
Right, so part of the reason that I had to get so frustrated, and I sort of painted myself into a corner here, was because I wanted a very specific view in this particular scene, because it's a very important scene, and I had to figure out how it was going to work in how this building was built. And so I actually had to draw on a post-it note, which I'm holding right now, several floor plans of this building that I've designed, which is only three screens, but then this last screen was the top of it. And so I had to plan it out and see how it was shaped and how it would be possible to get there. And then, so then finally I figured it out, and then I couldn't draw it right because the perspective was off. I actually had to fold the post-it note into threes to see how the architecture works, to see how the roof would work. So, so that was my...
The Sims, that's what I do.
Yeah, no, I thought about that. But it would mean I would have to reinstall The Sims. I thought about using SketchUp.
That's a trap. No, I just built it in The Sims. I mean, The Sims isn't very powerful, but for really basic stuff, I've done that.
Yeah. The thing is that, like, you get all these, and I've totally gone off on a tangent here, but you get all these, and in my book too, it's like all these perspective tutorials on how to draw slanted roofs, but slanted roofs that have the slant in the middle, you know? Mm-hmm. But there isn't really anything that shows you how to do roofs that slant with a flat top, and then the slant is on either side of those. And it's difficult to get that in perspective, because even if you're doing two-point perspective, that helps you define the plane of the flat surface, but you sort of have to eyeball the slants. So,
well, remember when I show you that if you draw a box in perspective and then put the slant as a midsection of that box, you can get the correct perspective of the slant?
Yeah, that's what I ended up figuring out at the end.
Yeah, that's what you do.
But, yeah.
I never do it because I'm lazy and awful, but that's what you should do.
I'll have to show it to you after the podcast to see if I got it right, but I might need some help with that.
Well, we went over it for about half an hour when we
were
showing you.
We did. Anyway.
So hopefully... Anyway.
Hopefully something stuck. Anyway, so basically what we wanted to tell everyone here was, you know, there are definitely motifs, there's definitely things that are there because they work, but the important thing is to make them work in your own way and not rely on cheap uses of them, because that's when it's bad.
Well, I hate the word cheap and I hate the word lazy, but be thoughtful and be sensitive to what your greater ideal and what your greater... plan is, and make everything that you do work towards your goal. Don't do it because you go, well, this will be funny, and I'm just making a game and games are meant to be funny. Have a goal in mind and work towards that goal. Make your games consistent, and if you're gonna break the consistency, do it with reason and do it with forethought.
Yeah, if you're gonna FOPs in your game, put them in for a reason, not just because you like FOPs.
Sometimes you like FOPs. You just want to put them in a game.
Exactly. And sometimes you can make your game work with FOPs.
Yeah, so, but I think in saying that, I also think it's cool to just do stuff because.
Yeah,
but,
sure.
But not huge story decisions and stuff like that, you know.
Right, right.
So, basically, I have no advice to give, as you
Very good. Well,
if you want to follow us on Twitter.
Yeah, if you want to follow us on Twitter, you can follow us. I'm at Grundislav Games.
I'm at Ben_304. And together,
we are at BCT _ podcast. Well, good. I guess that's about it, really. No clever post Twitter thing to say this week. No songs to sing. I don't know. I really don't know. We should probably end this. Bye.
Goodbye.